WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's not just Friday, it's Follow-Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper into some things that came up briefly earlier in the week. You may have heard our broadcast on Tuesday from WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space, where we acknowledge the 40th anniversary of Stonewall and the future of the LGBT movement. Well, we gathered a dozen people, roughly, including Stonewall vets, LGBT activists and LGBT youth. And one of our guests was Pauline Park, co-founder of the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy. That's a transgender rights group. Here she is from Tuesday's show.
Right now, the media are only talking about the marriage equality bill in the state Senate. We would certainly like to see the marriage equality bill voted on. We'd also like to see GENDA, the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, voted on, as well as DASA, the Dignity for All Students Act, which would prohibit discrimination and bias harassment in public schools throughout the state. There are many other issues that need to be addressed.
So we only got to touch on transgender rights briefly in that wide-ranging discussion, but that is the T in LGBT, so let's look a little more closely. And Pauline Park is back with us this morning to unpack some of these state and local initiatives affecting transgender individuals specifically. And Pauline, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian.
So we've been waiting to see if our state senators can get it together enough to take a vote on anything, including same-sex marriage legislation. But as you said on Tuesday, that's not the only LGBT issue on the table. What is the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act?
The Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act would amend state human rights law to add gender identity and gender expression as protected categories, protecting people from discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodations, credit, and education throughout the state. Right now, only New York City, the cities of Rochester, Albany, the county of Suffolk, and one or two small municipalities like Ithaca protect transgender and gender variant people from discrimination.
And that's gender expression rather than sexual orientation. So it's already legal. It's already illegal in some places to discriminate on the basis of whether someone is gay or straight, but it's not illegal to discriminate on the basis of somebody appearing to be transgendered?
That's precisely right. The Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act, SONDA, the gay rights bill, passed the state Senate in December 2002. And so discrimination based on sexual orientation has been prohibited under state law since 2002, but it is perfectly legal for someone to fire someone from a job or deny them access to health care or to deny them service in a restaurant or in a department store simply because they're transgendered or gender variant or appear to be.
And there's another related bill on the table, the Dignity for All Students Act. What's that?
The Dignity Bill would prohibit discrimination and bias-based harassment in public schools throughout the state. It has been pending in our state legislature now for 9 years. And, yes, our fast-moving state legislature. And, in fact, bias-based harassment is a serious problem in schools throughout the state. There have been serious incidents of bullying and harassment in New York City public schools, the New York City Council actually enacted the Dignity in All Schools Act, which is a very similar piece of legislation, back in 2004 over Mayor Michael Bloomberg's veto. However, the Bloomberg administration has refused to implement the law. The Department of Education will not take the steps that we have called on them to take, which are articulated in DASA, the Dignity Law, to protect students from bullying and bias-based harassment. And unfortunately, the Speaker of the City Council, Christine Quinn, also has done nothing to effectively address the epidemic of bullying and bias-based harassment in public schools.
Let me ask you more about Quinn, because I know you were at a demonstration yesterday where you spoke out against the City Council Speaker. Now, she is, of course, the first openly gay speaker of the City Council in history, and so I think people might assume that she would be sympathetic to LGBT initiatives, and she, of course, is sympathetic to some, but you think she doesn't get it on transgender issues?
I don't think it's a question of not getting it. I think as an individual, I have no doubt that she understands the issues. It's really about making a commitment as a policymaker to addressing these issues in a forthright and effective manner. The speaker, unfortunately, has not supported a progressive LGBT-inclusive agenda as the speaker of the city council. There is, of course, tremendous symbolic significance in having an out lesbian council speaker, but in practice, she's actually not at all been an ally of the LGBT community. She's really undermined efforts of LGBT activists and progressive activists to try to advance a progressive LGBT inclusive agenda in the council. One example, and this is why we were demonstrating against her last night, is that unfortunately she is blocking the New York City Human Rights Governmental Operations and Audit Law bill, New York City Human Rights Goal, which is intro number 731, the campaign for which is being spearheaded by the Human Rights Project of the Urban Justice Center. That bill has been pending in the City Council for over 6 years, and in her 4 years as Speaker, she's essentially colluded with the mayor to block the bill, which would fundamentally transform the way the City of New York handles civil rights and human rights. Right now, we have a very passive civil rights model. If you think you've been the victim of discrimination, you can go down to Rector Street and file a complaint with the City Human Rights Commission and hope that they take up your case. Human Rights Goal would transform the way the city handles civil rights and human rights, turning it into a much more proactive approach and mandating that every city agency proactively and effectively address discrimination before it happens, across the board, not only with regard to discrimination based on gender identity and expression and sexual orientation, but also race, ethnicity, religion, gender, disability.
And we can take some phone calls for Pauline Park, co-founder of the transgender rights group, the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, or NIAGRA. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, because, hey, there is just not much discussion of this in the media. People say LGBT as a shorthand all the time, but then when we talk about the issues, it's almost always about gay marriage or things that focus specifically on the lesbian and gay parts of LGBT, not the T part. So let's get to know a little bit more about what this really is, what this really is about in a legal sense, why there are issues here. And, just take a few minutes here to get to know a little better for people who've never thought very much one way or the other about some of these issues. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to our comments page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Other transgendered folks can call up or anybody else with a question or a comment. And Pauline, just to kind of reflect a little bit what's probably out there right now. There are some people probably thinking, well, okay, it took me a while, but I got it about gays and lesbians and why they should be treated equally. But they say that that's the way they were born, and an orientation is not a choice. Should I look at transgendered people in the same way, or why shouldn't I just think of this as weird? Because I'm sure you get this all the time. People think that someone who appears to be transgendered is weird. So you want to start that basic?
Well, I think at the most basic level, choice is actually, in my view, irrelevant to the issue at hand. It's important for people to recognize that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, as well as state and local law, protect people on the basis of characteristics that are not, in fact, immutable characteristics or practices or beliefs. For example, freedom of religion and religious affiliation. Religious affiliation is ultimately a choice. Even if you're born into a family with a particular religious affiliation, you can certainly change that. So, in fact, both our Constitution and Bill of Rights and state and local law protect people on the basis of a wide variety of characteristics, behaviors, and beliefs that are not all rooted in immutable characteristics. But I certainly think that we're in the middle of a sea change in terms of attitudes towards transgendered and gender variant people. Ultimately, these issues are not simply about a small number of people who decide to choose their sex, to change their sex through hormone replacement therapy and sex reassignment surgery. They're ultimately about a larger system of the regulation of gender identity and expression. And that plays out in a number of areas. Just let me mention two others. Mm-hmm. One is access to health care, and the other is the criminal justice system and the police. Niagara, along with our sister organization, the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, have initiated a project called the Transgender Health Initiative of New York, FINI, as we affectionately call it. And you can find out more about that on transgenderlegal.org or niagara.com. And it's a project designed to enhance access to health care for transgendered and gender variant people throughout the New York City metropolitan area. Right now, even though in theory discrimination based on gender identity or expression is prohibited under city human rights law since 2002, when we were able to get the city council to enact the transgender rights law, unfortunately, most healthcare providers have no understanding of transgender issues, which go well beyond simply questions of changing one's anatomical or biological sex. So that's one major project we're mm-hmm. involved with. We're also, and I think this is important, particularly for a public radio station to talk about, engaged with the hospitals and the Health and the Hospitals Corporation, HHC, which runs city hospitals, in order to make them more transgender sensitive in their provision of care. And then finally, briefly, we're also engaged on a number of fronts in addressing discrimination in the criminal justice system, which unfortunately delivers criminal injustice to most transgendered and gender variant people, particularly transgendered people of color, who may face police harassment not only on the basis of their race or ethnicity, but also on the basis of their gender identity or perceived gender identity. There is a level of gender identity profiling that goes on in the city that many people don't realize. If you are perceived to be transgendered, in some cases the police will harass you and assume that you're engaged in sex work simply by virtue of your gender identity.
And this is also an issue in Congress, that is legal protections for transgendered people. Just earlier this week, the House of Representatives started taking up the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, a bill which would protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender employees from workplace discrimination. And that bill explicitly includes transgender protections to existing federal employment non-discrimination laws. And President Obama has said that he's in favor of its passage. So this isn't just a city council issue or a waiting for the state Senate to get back to work issue. This is even on the table in Congress for anybody who doesn't think that this is mainstream. Russ on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Great show.
Thank you.
I'd like to preface my comment with the fact that I think the whole need for this kind of conversation is ridiculous. I mean, there should just be equal rights for gay, straight, transgender, whoever and whatever. But my question is this. Why is specific transgender legislation required? Wouldn't a transgender person still be either male or female and therefore be protected underneath the same standard gender discrimination legislation? You know, there is no male, female, or other checkbox on any government form that you might fill out.
Good question, Pauline.
That's a great question, Ross. The short answer to it is that courts are generally extremely conservative in interpreting statute law. And what that means is that unless there's explicit language that a state legislature or city council or Congress, for that matter, at the federal level, enacts to add a definition of sex or gender to law, in most jurisdictions it's actually sex. Under New York state law, it's sex. They change that under New York City law to gender. But unless there's explicit language, courts generally will not find in favor of a transgendered plaintiff who sues for discrimination based on gender identity and expression. There are a few exceptions. There have been a few breakthroughs in different federal and state courts around the country. But in general, without explicit language defining sex or gender to include gender identity and gender expression, those statutes or provisions are not useful for transgendered people who have been the victims of discrimination in employment, housing, or public accommodation.
Russ, thank you for your call. Diana in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Diana.
Hi, how are you? It's Diana Montfort. Hi, Pauline. You're great. You're doing beautifully. I really think that part of the problem starts with the white male gay community, that they tend to marginalize and discriminate against trans folk, and that they feel a certain amount of condescension and disdain for us, and that that bleeds out into the larger community. And I think that really we have to start changing attitudes with our own community, because usually the, you know, prosperous upper middle class white male gay community, they seem to feel that we are somehow less than they are, that we are somehow less than most people are. And I think that just as they disdain genetic women, they disdain transgender folk. They disdain male to female transgender folk. They are less disdainful of female to male transgender people, because, of course, what's the greatest crime in our society? Being a woman. So I really think we have to start changing attitudes as far as we can among the, you know, gay white male patriarchy.
Well, Pauline Park, is that too hardcore identity politics for you? Do you agree that the greatest crime in our society is being a woman, or that the root of discrimination against transgender folks starts with gay white men?
I would say that I think that there is a subtle but very powerful relationship between oppression based on sexual orientation, you might call homophobia, and discrimination and oppression based on gender identity or expression. I think they're mutually reinforcing discourses of oppression. I think that there are elements within the community who are more privileged, who generally are reluctant to take political risks to advance legislation or public policy that includes transgendered people. I would be reluctant to generalize. I do think there's been an enormous change since we founded Niagara back in 1998. No one in the city used the phrase LGBT. It's now become standard, and major institutions in the community, including the LGBT Community Center, among others, have changed their name to reflect transgender inclusion as a result of action taken by Niagara and other transgender advocacy organizations. So I think that there is a change going on, but it is true, as Diana says, that there's some resistance, particularly from more privileged elements within the LGBT community. But having said that, there's also a huge level of support that I see among non-transgendered lesbian, gay, bisexual people for full transgender inclusion, because what that means in law, gender identity and expression also reinforces protections for non-transgendered lesbian, gay, bisexual people. In theory, right, there's a potential loophole if you include only sexual orientation in law.
Pauline Park is the co-founder of the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, or NIAGRA, a follow-up Friday segment after she appeared briefly in our Green Space LGBT event on Tuesday. Pauline, thank you very much for coming back on.
Thank you so much, Brian.
It's not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday, and as you know, all month we've been talking about the unwritten rules of getting around, etiquette for being on the subway, on the sidewalk, and yesterday, how to behave on airplanes. And one listener called in to complain about people who talk loudly on their cell phone or talk at all on their cell phone as the plane is taxiing on or off the runway. And we began to discuss the whole thing about having to turn off your cell phones and other electronic devices before flying. Someone on our team expressed serious skepticism that your laptop or BlackBerry could bring down a multimillion-dollar jumbo jet. And our guest, Billy Cohen of Time Out New York, who was with us on the air yesterday, sort of agreed. Listen to this exchange.
I have the same doubt as well, but I don't really want to take the chance. So I'd probably call the flight attendant, you know, and ask if it was all right. Maybe they could voice your concern for you.
Right, and maybe somebody will know. That'll be a good one for a follow-up segment tomorrow. Or if anybody in the airline industry is listening right now, our lines are full, but post to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Tell us the real skinny there, okay? Do iPods, iPhones, laptops actually interfere with any of the controls in the airplane? So that was yesterday, and lo and behold, our comments page filled up with theories and opinions. And tucked in there was a note from listener James Talbot, who happens to fly 747s out of LaGuardia for a major airline. He said that if we called him, he would give us the answer. So earlier today, we reached James on his way to the airport, and I asked him point blank, can my cell phone interfere with your job?
Well, I think generally the FAA takes kind of a one-size-fits-all approach. Older aircraft that are less computerized, like the 727 DC-10s, DC-9s, MD-80s, they're probably less susceptible to any sort of radio interference. But now with the newer generation aircraft, the Airbuses, A330s, 340s, the 320s, that are highly computerized and with the use of electronic flight or navigation systems, the EFIS flat panel displays, and we've gotten away from the old kind of instrumentation, those would be more susceptible. And there was a study done several years ago where it was shown with a lot of devices there could be some interference. So I think the FAA has just come out and said, you know, just turn them all off, and that's the safest way. One or two cell phones probably wouldn't cause any problem, but when you have 200 or 250 people in the back of the plane with some sort of device on, whether it be a laptop with a wireless mouse, a cell phone, you're texting a Game Boy, anything like that, that could potentially cause a problem, and it's obviously the most critical when you'd be doing an approach, and you know, you're close to the ground, and precision navigation's required, and you can't have any sort of interference. So leaving a cell phone on. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish the thought.
I was just saying, leaving a cell phone on and then discovering it, that you hadn't turned it off in flight isn't going to, you know, cause any problem. And obviously, it's happened many times. It's happened to pilots plenty of times.
But
where you're a few hours into the flight and you look down, or you pull out your cell phone to look at something, maybe in the you know, the airplane mode of an iPhone, and you realize you've left it on. And so,
is it more dangerous if you're using it, talking on a cell phone, than if it's just on?
I guess it probably would be, because the biggest risk would be transmitting signals. I'm not an electronics expert by any means, but the idea of something that sends a signal or receives a signal, that's where the interference could be generated.
Well, that makes sense. And that sending a signal concern, that's why you said a wireless mouse. So it's not so much having a laptop on, per se, but if you're using a wireless mouse with it, then you may be contributing to something.
Exactly. That or with a cell phone. A cell phone's going to be sending a signal and receiving. Right. And that's where the concern arises.
Has there ever been an incident, as far as you know? Has there ever been an incident?
Not that I'm aware of. I think I'm not sure if it was the FAA that did the study or another group, but I do recall a study several years ago where they said with a lot of devices on board an aircraft, they were able to determine that there was some interference. I don't remember the type of aircraft or how many devices, but I do remember it was significant. It was like, you know, over 100 Game Boys or cell phones or anything that's got something going on, and they were able to come up with, yes, this is a problem. So
if the person...
I think you're talking hundreds, 100 to 200 devices going off in the back of the aircraft where it could generate some sort of, magnetic or radio magnetic interference, or that's what I got out of it. And so instead of kind of coming up and saying, on this aircraft it doesn't have any effect, this one it does, they just have a sweeping regulation where they say, right. all of them off.
So turn off your cell phone is now part of your checklist as a
pilot. That's correct. I don't think it had anything to do with the crash that occurred at the commuter train out in Los Angeles where I think it was determined the conductor, or I don't know what you call the guy, the engineer, I guess, had been texting and had gone through the stop signal and caused that crash. But shortly after that, we had a revision to a checklist, the Force Engines checklist, where one of the final items on the checklist was EFB and PED off, and PED is personal electronic devices.
Right. Well, there you go.
And that's for us to remember to turn ours off as well.
So you're on your way to the airport to fly now. You told us where you're flying to.
I'm actually going to Calgary, but it's a personal trip. I'm on a bike trip up in the Rockies.
That's great. Flying to the bicycle. I like that commute. James, thanks a lot for chiming in. This has been really informative, and now we know that even though it may take hundreds of cell phones to cause a crash, and that it may never have actually happened yet as far as we know, we should give a good, stern, dirty look to people next to us if the plane is getting ready to take off or to land and they're ignoring the warning to turn off the phones, right?
Exactly, yeah. Better safe than sorry, obviously.
Right. Thanks a lot. Happy flight.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now that we've cleared that up, we'll come back in a minute and talk about staycation walking tours, how to see your own city with fresh eyes this summer on foot. Stay with us.